From the Blue Ridge Mountains to the Chesapeake Bay, Virginia is a mecca for outdoor travel and adventure. Virginia Outdoor Adventures podcast is the ultimate guide for local outdoor recreation, including hiking, camping, kayaking, and so much more. Get the information and the inspiration to plan your own adventure right here in Virginia. I'm your host, Jessica Bowser. The experience of a backcountry trip immerses us in nature in a way that a day hike just can't match. Backpacking can build confidence, provide a true sense of independence, and foster a love of the great outdoors. But maybe the idea of packing up and heading into the wilderness is overwhelming or even intimidating. Allison Wada, backpacking guide and owner of Exploration Solo, addresses the most common concerns of beginner backpackers, including selecting and packing gear, meal preparation, navigation, safety, and even the dreaded bathroom situation. Allison offers step-by-step advice and helps you find the best resources and support to get you ready for the adventure of a lifetime. Let's go! Virginia Outdoor Adventures is sponsored by the Virginia Association for Parks. VAFP is the advocacy organization representing parks across the Commonwealth. What's your favorite memory from a Virginia park? Help ensure that everyone can experience our parks for generations to come. Join VAFP today by visiting virginiaparks.org or click Virginia Association for Parks in the show notes of your listening app. Blue Ridge Outdoors Magazine takes readers deep into the mountains, covering adventure, recreation, travel, and culture. The largest free, independent outdoor lifestyle magazine in the country, Blue Ridge Outdoors is dedicated to inspiring people in the Blue Ridge and beyond to go outside and play. Every issue includes coverage of top scenic destinations, multi-sport spotlights, interviews with inspiring adventurers, new gear reviews, and features on regional music and culture. Check out Blue Ridge Outdoors Magazine on Newsstands Monthly or click the link in your show notes to visit BlueRidgeOutdoors.com. Allison, welcome to Virginia Outdoor Adventures.
Thank you. I am so excited to be here.
What do you love about Virginia's outdoors?
You know, I think for me, one of the things about Virginia is that I sometimes feel like I'm in this incredibly unique area that doesn't exist anywhere else. So like Grayson Highlands, there's an area with some rocks and it has this almost prehistoric vibe, like it's never been touched by man or time. And then Back Bay, I love walking through Back Bay with its African Sahara vibe. I sometimes expect Simba to come out and say hi. You know, these are just these unique experiences that you don't see anywhere else.
What sparked your interest in backpacking?
Believe it or not, I was on a trip to Antarctica of all places, and I was inspired by the stories by our guides. And I thought, you know, I'm not living my life. I want to get out. I want to do more. And I had an interest in camping. When I came home, I found an intro to backpacking course near me. A friend of mine actually had fortuitously just signed up for it also. And so I had a buddy with me. And after taking that class, I've just been hooked.
It does hook you pretty quickly. Like people try it and either it's not for them or they absolutely love it. I feel like that's a pretty typical reaction to backpacking.
It's true. There's no, I could take it or leave it, or at least that's pretty rare.
Yeah. So how did you transition from a beginner backpacker to a backpacking guide?
You know, it's kind of funny because it seems like it's this big jump, but the learning curve with backpacking is pretty steep. By your fourth or fifth trip, you really start to have things down. I mean, we always learn, we're always evolving, but you've pretty much got the basics down by your fourth or fifth trip. And I initially began by leading day hikes for the group that I was a part of where I learned to backpack. So I just, you know, was leading some of the day hikes. Then I assisted on a couple of trips. And then pretty soon I was just leading trips on my own and then started teaching the intro to backpacking course. It really just takes being confident in your own skills, knowing what you can handle, what comes your way, and a desire to help other people love the outdoors.
So since you work with a lot of newbies, I'll bet you hear a lot of concerns and roadblocks that people feel like they reach when they think about backpacking. So what are the most common concerns or roadblocks that you hear from beginner backpackers?
Well, and I think you're probably going to agree with me on this one. I would say that the number one thing that comes up is there's this huge concern about going to the bathroom in the woods.
Yes.
And I know it sounds silly, but it's a deal breaker for a lot of people. People get really, really like, I can't do it. I can't do it. I think it stems from concerns that someone's going to invade your privacy. There's no doors. Anybody can walk up on you, and it's a pretty vulnerable moment. And also, I think a lot of people think it's going to be messy. It's really not that bad. And I think people are building it up to be more than it is in their head, but I do understand the concern. Cost is another deal breaker for a lot of people. A lot of people get really excited, and then they're like, oh, I'm going backpacking, and they go to the outfitter store, and you're like, wait a minute, I'm $500 in, and I've only bought like 2.5 items. And there are ways to get that cost down. I mean, you can borrow, you can rent. There are discount areas, but I can, it's expensive, and if you didn't know that going in, it can be a bit of a shock when you're at the store. And then I think overall, I'm just going to categorize it as fear. Fear of the unknown, fear of animals, fear you're going to get lost, fear you won't be able to pitch your tent, all of those what ifs. I think people just get, they make it out to be this really huge event in their mind rather than realize that it's a bunch of manageable steps. So, I mean, everything here can be addressed. It's really just about helping people understand that it's more basic than you think, and you can do this.
What a great point. Those are all concerns that I hear from people regularly. They do get really worried and worked up in their minds about what if, and what if I can't do this? What if something happens? And they're all legitimate concerns. If you've never done it before and you don't know what you don't know, then of course you're going to be nervous about it, and of course you're going to feel apprehensive about it. So I'd like to kind of, if it's okay with you, could we sort of go through some of those concerns and hear what your recommendations are for each of those things?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first one about, going to the bathroom in the woods. If you're worried about privacy, and I will say that's a legitimate concern. I have had people walk by me before. I mean, we've all been there. If you're concerned, you can always have a trusted friend or someone, kind of stand away from you, but kind of keep guard to make sure that, nobody's coming your way so that you can feel like you have some good privacy there. And then from it being messy, it really isn't. I mean, I think with that, just letting people know, yes, you dig the hole, but honestly, you just use a stick to put the dirt back over. And I think just explaining to people, it's no worse than going to the bathroom at home. The only difference is you use a little dirt to cover it instead of hit the flush button.
Yeah, but
And
before you jump on to the next thing, can you talk about what the proper ways to dispose of human waste
sure.
are in the wilderness?
Yeah, no, this is a good one. What you need to do is, especially for number two, you need to dig a hole about 6 to 8 inches deep. And I will say a lot of people are like, oh, that's 6 inches, but we're really bad at gauging depth. So if you think it's six, go a few more inches.
Well, and it's hard in the mountains too, because you start to dig and you almost instantly hit a rock or a root. It's not as easy as you think it is.
Oh my gosh, that's like the word, the roots definitely are like, so sometimes you dig and you're like, all right, well, I'm gonna have to go move somewhere else. And that is but once you find a spot, or I ask other people, I'm like, well, where did you go? And they're like, it's the dirt's good over here. But you can get these lightweight trowels that they it, I think it's called the Deuce of Spades, and it's actually just very, very lightweight, and it digs a hole really well. I use a bandana around the handle so I don't, because it can be kind of sharp, but it really digs and it can get through the roots. You could also use a knife to cut through the roots if you want to. To be honest, I sometimes have better luck with the heel of my boot and a trekking pole. Sometimes the boot just digs that hole a little bit, and then I use the trekking pole to kind of sort of finesse it out a little bit. So you're going to make your cat hole, and then you go to the bathroom, and then you're going to cover the hole back up with the dirt you just removed from it. And I usually just find a stick nearby and use that. When it comes to toilet paper, there's two schools of thought. A lot of people are just say, I just bury it with everything else because it's biodegradable. I personally carry mine out. I have just, I mean, yeah, you bury it, but it's going to take months for it to biodegrade. And You've probably seen this. You go to a campsite and there's toilet paper everywhere. And some of it's human, but some of it are just animals digging through the dirt and then they dig up the toilet paper and then it just gets everywhere. I just carry it out. It's not that gross. You can buy bags on Amazon that you can't see through. And they're like these brown Ziploc bags, and I just tuck it in there, and then I put that in another Ziploc, and then it just goes in my toiletry bag. It doesn't smell, it's not gross. And then when the first trash can I hit on the way out, it just gets dropped in it.
Yeah, that's really smart. Do you have some other first steps that you recommend for someone who's never backpacked before?
I think if you can, I would try and find a course. I think it's a great way to get started. You've got some structure and you'll meet people. Like you'll immediately be with people that might be your future backpacking buddies. It's how I got started, and the people I go backpacking with now, I met all of them through that course and that group. So it just was a really good way for me to not just get started, but to keep going. There are also groups that welcome beginners. You could look at Meetup and Facebook. You can also Google like backpacking courses Virginia. I actually did find a couple of options in Virginia. There were some places that looked like they offered, getting started backpacking courses. If you are going to try and do it on your own, because a lot of people do, I would recommend following a bunch of different people on YouTube and, reading through a bunch of different blogs online. Backpackers are opinionated. You may have run into this, You'll hear a lot of like, do this, don't do this. You have to buy this. Go with a one person tent. You don't want a two person tent. There's no right or wrong way to do this. It's all personal preference. But if you watch multiple people, you'll hear someone say, "Oh, don't buy this tent. It's the worst tent ever." And then you'll hear somebody else say, "Oh, I love this tent. Everybody should use it." But in explaining it, you're getting why they don't like it and why they do. And you can start to realize, well, the guy who says he doesn't like it, I'm okay with what he's saying or problems. And what the guy who loves it is saying, I really like those options. This might be a good tent for me. So I think that's why I really think you should really listen to a bunch of different people to really just get that sense of what do you think is going to work for you.
I love Facebook and meetup groups. I mean, first of all, it gets you excited about getting out and doing this more because you are in contact with people who love it and you sort of feel that excitement and you want to be a part of it. It's also really great for recommendations, like you said. If you are looking to buy a piece of gear and you're online and you're reading reviews and you're looking at one thing or another thing and you just can't make up your mind, sometimes putting the question out there for the whole group to say, "Hey, I'm stuck between this and this. What do you all think? Has anybody used it before? What is your experience?" And immediately people will start to respond. And almost always somebody will have something to say that you didn't find online when you were reading the reviews or when you were looking at a brand's website, for instance. And so things to consider that you wouldn't have thought or even known to think about before then. So I find it super helpful.
Oh, absolutely. Backpackers at their heart want to be helpful. I mean, yeah, we may have our opinions on like what we like and what's good and what's not, but at the end of the day, we want other people to be successful. And when you're out backpacking or online asking questions, you're just going to find the friendliest group of people who truly just want you to succeed and have a good time.
Camping season is back, and I'm ready to hit the trails in my brand new camping hammock by Hennessy Hammock. Hennessy offers a variety of camping hammock sizes and styles to fit your needs. I opted for the ultralight Backpacker Classic with a unique and innovative bottom entry design that makes it easier for me to get in and out of the hammock, and it prevents those pesky bugs from following me inside. Hennessy also offers the zippered side entry model for those who prefer the traditional style. Every Hennessy hammock features a patented structural ridgeline for easy setup, exceptionally strong suspension ropes, a matching asymmetrical waterproof rainfly, tightly woven mesh to keep even the smallest pests out, high density fabric so mosquitoes won't bite through the hammock, and it even has a gear pocket to hold your phone, light, book, and other belongings inside the hammock. I've tried a lot of camping beds and sleeping options over the years that have been uncomfortable and leave me stiff, tired, and cranky in the morning. With my new Hennessy hammock, all these problems have been solved. I got the best night's sleep outdoors that I've ever had. The light pack weight and easy setup makes this hammock the perfect option for all my camping and backpacking needs. It's no wonder Hennessy hammocks are called the coolest tent in the world. Ready for your best night under the stars? Click on Hennessy Hammock in the show notes of your listening app to visit HennessyHammock.com. Right. There is also bad advice out there. So walk me through how to choose appropriate gear, just to make sure that we don't run into the bad advice.
Yeah. And I mean, this is, this is an entire day's worth of conversation. But I'm going to narrow it down a little bit. So, I mean, first things first, you can find a lot of information online. And a lot of it is just about listening. Don't listen to the must do's, don't ever do's. I mean, just ignore that and just listen to what they're saying about the information. Also, be careful about reviews. Make sure you're reading them. You don't want to just look at a tent and be like, oh, there's all these 5-star reviews. Look, I love the thru hikers. I do. They're the friendliest people. I've run into them before, but they give some of the worst 5-star reviews I've ever seen. You'll see something like, oh, the tent got a bunch of holes in it and it leaked all night, but it was only a pound and I love it. 5 stars.
Wow.
And you're sitting there going, so if you don't read the review, you might think this is like the tent for you. And for a thru hiker, you know, they have a different need. There's a different mindset. So you really need to read the reviews and hear what they're saying. And I think that's true for any backpacking item. Just make sure you're actually reading the views. Don't just look at the number of stars. The big 4 items are going to be your tent, sleeping bag, sleeping pad, and your backpack itself. I would buy your backpack last. What you buy, the tent, the sleeping bag, all of that is going to impact your pack because it has to fit in it. So if the less something weighs, the more expensive it's going to be. Mm-hmm. With backpacking, lower weight equals pricier item. That's just how it is. So as you're buying things, you may say, you know, I really want this $250 down sleeping bag that weighs a pound, but I can't really afford that. I'm going to buy this $100, sleeping bag that weighs maybe 2.5 pounds and it doesn't compress quite so much. Well, that sleeping bag now has to fit in your pack. And if it doesn't compress as far as a different one would, you just have to think about that. So I would get all of your gear first, then look at the pack to just make sure everything fits in it. So that's one of my big things. Everything else is preference. You know, 1-person tent versus a 2-person tent. You know, 2-person tent weighs more, but if you're stuck in your tent and it's raining, because it's raining all day, that's a lot of me, myself, and I time. And the bigger the tent, the more room you have, the more you can do. But again, a 1-person tent is going to weigh less. So there's just some things that's personal preference, and you're going to have to decide, you know, what you prefer. I personally recommend a freestanding tent for beginners. A freestanding tent is one with poles. There are also trekking pole tents where it's just the tent and some stakes, and then you use your 2 hiking poles to prop it up and pitch it that way. Freestanding tents, so the ones that actually come with the poles that crisscross across the top of it, those are easier to pitch and they're a lot more forgiving. You don't need a perfect area to pitch it. If there's like a little bit of divot in the grass, if there's a little bit of hill, if the land's not perfect, it's going to be more forgiving for you. Trekking pole tents, you have to really find a good spot to get the optimal pitch for it. And while it's not necessarily a comfort thing, if it rains and your tent isn't pitched correctly, you can run into some leak, you know, some issues where like the water's running, you know, under the tent and things like that. So I personally just think when you're getting started, a freestanding tent is going to make your life a lot easier. I would start with a 30-degree sleeping bag. I think that's going to be fine for 3/4 of the year. I know, as you and I found out, sometimes a 10-degree sleeping bag doesn't quite cut it.
All right.
But that was in the middle of winter. But a 30 degree bag is going to get you through spring, summer, and most of early fall. You really don't need to go down to a 20 degree. I mean, there's some exceptions, but really a 20 degree is going to be more mid to late fall on. I personally would aim for a sleeping bag under 2.5 pounds. I definitely wouldn't go over three. While it may cost more, the lighter weight, just the less bulk and the lighter weight of it is going to make your life easier. I would also, some people might say differently, but if you want to try and camp backpack year round, or at least into late fall, I would get an insulated sleeping pad. It's going to weigh a little bit more, but the uninsulated ones, I wouldn't take them down past 40 degrees. You're going to get cold at night without the insulation. And then really everything else is, you're going to need a water filter system. Most people use the Sawyer squeeze. You're going to have to find a pot. You're going to have to find a stove, like all of that. And that's really just getting down to personal preference. One thing I will say, safety devices are important. Don't skimp on those. Your headlamp needs to be at least 300 lumens. I would maybe look for a 350 or 400. You want that to be nice and bright. And if you're going to be by yourself, I would highly recommend a satellite communication device. It's going to be expensive, but it is worth it if you're by yourself. Anybody who's been out, even in the state parks, your cell phone doesn't work. I think they have, I don't know, but I'm telling you, your cell phone doesn't work. A satellite communication device is going to allow you to keep in touch with friends and family. And you can get an SOS out. I know you can do that now with the iPhones, but the Garmins and the Zolios are a little bit more proven.
That's a lot. I mean, we could do an entire episode, I think, on gear, just like you said, and some of these other topics that I think we're going to cover too. But I think that gives people a basis, like the basic things that they need to look for when it comes to the tent. Yeah, I mean, let's let everybody in on the little inside joke, right? Like you and I went
Oh yeah.
camping not too long ago. How cold did it get tonight? 20 degrees or something
They
like
said
that?
20, but there was a wind, and I think we were in a cold patch. I was in a 10-degree sleeping bag, and I was freezing.
Yeah. I mean, I had a 10 degree, I think it was 10 degree sleeping bag too. Plus, I mean, we put blankets down on the bottom of the tent. We put insulated pads down. I had like five layers of my heaviest clothing on. I had hand warmers, foot warmers. My head was covered, like not even my nose was sticking out. The blanket was over my head. And yet I was still shivering. And when we woke up in the morning, the inside of our tent was just like enveloped in ice.
Yeah, I mean, I've been in 15 degree weather before, and it wasn't that cold, but I think it just goes to show that when you're in the mountains, the mountains make their own weather, and that's very, very true. And
Yes.
it's hard to gauge by temperature what you're going to need sometimes, because like I said, I've been in 15 degree overnights, and it was not as cold as this 25 degree overnight. The wind makes a difference. How much humidity is in the air? Water will make it cold feel a lot colder. So, you need to be prepared for anything.
Yeah, and we were car camping too, so we weren't backpacking at that time, but it makes me think about something you said about the tents. So I was sleeping in sort of the standard two-person tent, and you were sleeping in a one-person tent that you needed trekking poles to pitch, right? And when I left, you switched tents.
I mean, absolutely, because again, the two person, and the difference was yours was a freestanding one too. The two person tent I knew was just going to be more comfortable, and that I could bring everything I wanted in with me. So, it's kind of funny. I got the one person tent, but I keep going to the two person because I'm just more comfortable in it. So,
Yeah, especially for car camping, because I had all those extra blankets and all those extra layers, and I had room for like a real pillow instead of an inflatable pillow. And I had my duffel bag with my clothes and like just all my stuff was in there, and it was all in one place. It would have really been uncomfortable if that would have been a one-person tent.
Yeah, no, definitely, definitely. It's the benefit of a two-person tent. You can get all of your stuff in there with you. So,
Right. Let's jump on to another topic that could also be an entire episode by itself. In fact, I did do an entire episode on this topic, back over the summer. So if anybody's looking for more detailed information about food prep, definitely check. There's a bonus episode over the summer with Aaron Owens Mayhew about trail food. But let's real quick talk about any advice you have for meal prep on the trail. And also importantly, how to properly store food when you're backpacking.
No, and this is a good one because I think it's actually with new backpackers in the intro class, the food is one of the, the things that they struggle with. You know, what am I going to eat? You know, the freeze-dried meals that you buy at Outfitters, I mean, those have gotten to be pretty good. The technology has gotten better. The flavors have gotten better. Although I will say they've also gotten more expensive. Mm-hmm. But if you're in a pinch, they are a very easy way to just get good nutrition on the trail. I have a dehydrator. I make my own meals. That way I know what's in it. So that's another thing you can do. And it's actually pretty easy to dehydrate food. There are also these recipes online where you purchase dried food, ingredients that are already dry, and then you just mix them together in a bag. And then when you get to camp, you just add hot water and they cook to make a meal. Lots of options. The other thing I will say, when you start backpacking, walk around the grocery store, but look at it with a new eye. So don't worry about the packaging. You can always repack things in like Ziploc bags and things like that. A lot of people like the Knorr sides, the rice sides or the pasta dishes, and they'll add textured vegetable protein or freeze-dried chicken to it. I enjoy the mashed potato packets. You can buy these little packets that they say there are 4 servings, but it's like 2. And again, you can add chicken or the TVP to it. So there are a lot of options out there for good food. For storage, so you can use a bear canister. There's also ursacs, or you can, just use like a dry bag and put your food in it and do a bear hang. The most important thing is that food needs to be at least 100 yards away from camp. That is 70 steps. I can't tell you how many people go about 10 steps and do a bear hang. You really need to get it out of camp. It's not so much about protecting your food. It's about protecting camp. So you just want to get things as far away from camp. If a bear gets your food, he gets your food, but at least he's away from camp. The bear hang done right, so 12 to 15 feet in the air, 5 feet from the trunk of the tree, should keep it safe. Although I've heard about bears like jumping on the tree branch to break it off, but it should keep it safe. If you're using a bear canister, you want to kind of tuck it into some, branches or things that are on the ground to just make it hard for the bear to get to. I personally like the ursac. I've bought one and I've gotten into it. It's basically a Kevlar sack because I don't know if you've noticed this, but like I'm finding more and more, there are not good trees for bear hangs. The trees just don't have good limbs. They're just too thin, or so many trees have fallen over. The ursac you just tie to a tree way far from camp, and because it's Kevlar, the bear can't get into it. So those are some options. If there is a bear locker, use it. It's there for a reason. And I will say, Virginia in a lot of areas, has had bear issues. So bear lockers are actually pretty common sight in a lot of areas in Virginia. You'll see them in Grayson Highlands and Mount Rogers. You'll also see them kind of up and down the AT in some areas. And it's easy. It's so easy. Just toss your food in it.
Yeah, I have not yet found a way to store my food that I actually really like. I've tried mm-hmm. lots of different things. When I was online shopping for different bear canisters, a lot of national parks will tell you need to have a canister or mm-hmm. you're not allowed to have a certain brand of canister because the bears have gotten into them or they have figured out how to open them. And in Shenandoah National Park, you're not required, I don't think, to have a bear canister, but there are people who have said that they've used certain brands of bear canister and the bears have gotten into them. So, and they're big and they're bulky. They take up a lot of space in your pack. Although they're nice to sit on as a little bench when they're not in your pack. And then hanging a bear bag, I have found, is actually way more difficult than you think, because being able to toss a bag far enough or the rope far enough, it almost always gets tangled up in other branches of other trees that are nearby. Like there's very rarely ever just a clear shot where you can just wing it and have it fly over the right branch the first time.
Oh, absolutely. And I do an underhand throw. I've tried the overhand throw, but that tends to hit things and come back at me. One of the keys is to really wait. So you basically, if people aren't familiar, you take like a little bag and you put a lot of rocks in it to weigh it down. Then you tie the rope to the bag and then you throw it over a tree so that the weight on the other end as it goes up and over brings it back down. But if it hits a knob on the tree, or if you throw it too hard and it goes woo, 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 so it goes around like three times, now you've got a problem. I find the underhand throw kind of prevents a lot of that. You really need to have a lot of weight in that rock bag. And I find that actually helps even if it gets caught in other tree, branches and stuff. It just the weight seems to carry it higher and then it brings it down on the other side. But yeah, especially in the spring, and then just you're like finding a tree far enough from camp that's thick enough to handle the weight and that's high enough off the ground and that you can, to your point, can actually get it over. It's just a nightmare.
Yeah, and I do what you do as far as making meals with a dehydrator. Last year for the holidays, I asked for a dehydrator because they're a little bit pricey, so you have to know that you're going to use it. And plenty of people use it for things that have nothing to do with making trail meals. There's lots of things you could do with a dehydrator. So if you think you're going to use it, it might be worth the investment. Or if you already have one, to start to think about dehydrating backpacking meals. But for me, I'm vegan and I'm also a very healthy eater, so I get really picky about additives and preservatives and things like that. So I have, on more than one occasion, been in REI, for example, standing in front of the wall of all the dehydrated prepackaged meals, and I start going through each one, like one by one by one, and reading the ingredients and ruling them out. And by the time I've gone through that entire wall of meals, I've got maybe three things in my hand that I would actually eat, and they're almost always oatmeal. And I could make my own oatmeal or bring my own oatmeal for a whole lot cheaper than what it costs to buy an oatmeal package. So I hear what you're saying. If you are like me and you're picky about what you eat, or you want to have different options, dehydrating is a really great activity. It does take some time. You're cooking and then you're putting it in the dehydrator and then you're storing it. But for me, it's worth that extra investment of time.
Yeah, what I do is I'll make whatever I want to dehydrate, I'll make it one night and then I'll eat a serving of it for dinner and I'll put the rest of it in the refrigerator. And then in the morning, because I find if it refrigerates, it helps a little bit. And then in the morning, I'll take it out and then just put it in the dehydrator in the morning and then I'll just plug it in and just let it go all day. For me, it's not really any extra effort than me cooking dinner that night. And I've got some tried and true recipes that work. Rehydrating can be a little problematic, but there are a lot of people online that have some really great dehydrator recipes and backpacking meal recipes. And I probably should follow some of them some more.
Yes, because one thing I learned that I didn't know when I first started out is that you cannot dehydrate any sort of fats. So that includes olive oil. And I tend to cook with a lot of olive oil. So I had to learn to cut that out because it will go rancid. It won't keep after you've dehydrated it.
Yeah, I mean, I might add a little bit. Like, I'll cook the meal and then dehydrate it, but then I put it in a food saver bag and suck the air out of it and then put it in my freezer.
Yeah, if you keep it in the freezer, then you're in better shape.
Yeah, you just have to remember to take it out the next, like, the you need to take it out well before you think of packing it in your bag. Otherwise, you now have like this frozen food in with your other food and everything gets wet.
That's right. I don't know about you, but I have never understood the mummy sleeping bag. Sure, they're designed to be light and warm, but they're restrictive and uncomfortable. There's no ability to move around or regulate body temperature. Wouldn't it be great if sleeping outside could feel like sleeping in your bed at home, even while backpacking? If you agree, you'll be just as excited as I was when I learned about Zen Bivy. The Zen Bivy bed is the first hybrid sleeping bag of its kind that matches a mummy bag in warmth to weight ratio and provides unparalleled versatility. The world's first two-piece sleeping bag, the Zen Bivy sleep systems are built like your bed at home, a sheet below you and a quilt above. This design allows for the most comfortable night's sleep in the backcountry without the constriction from traditional mummy bags. I wanted to try Zen Bivy's unique design, so I ordered the brand new Core Bed, which is Zen Bivy's simplest, softest, and most affordable backpacking bed. The first feature I fell in love with was the super soft fabrics on both the inside and outside of the bed. The quilt feels like it floats above me even when I'm fully clipped in, to give me complete freedom to move around during the night without feeling trapped. I love that the hood is integrated with the sheet to insulate my head and hold the pillow in place. The vast foot box gives my feet plenty of space and can be transformed from mummy shape to a spacious wide mode. The versatile design keeps me warm, but also allows me to move around. ZenBivy beds come in different temperature ratings, sizes, weights, and fill options, so you can choose the bed that best fits your needs for camping, backpacking, and everything in between. On your next adventure, sleep in a bed, not a bag. Discover the world's first hybrid sleeping bag by clicking on ZenBivy in the show notes of your listening app to visit ZenBivy.com. How do you choose a location? And that's another thing that I hear from people, is they want to go backpacking, but they don't know where they should go. Do you have any recommendations?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I do when I'm looking at where to go is, I mean, I just do the basics. I get on Google and I'm like, places to backpack in Virginia. And I start reading through, you know, some places that people have been, and just look to see, you know, how doable is it in the time allotted? Like, you know, how far of a drive is it for me? And then I start, you know, are there any alerts in the area, trail closings, rock slides, bears, anything like that? You know, how is parking? And if you go online, people will talk about parking. You know, is it safe? Can you park? Is it legal? Can you park overnight? So I'll look into all of that. And from there, I'll create a list and then really just think about, you know, well, which one sounds the most appealing. In a pinch, like if I'm in a rush and I don't have a lot of time to plan, I'll look to the Appalachian Trail, because Virginia's got some of the best Appalachian Trail. I mean, some of the scenery is unbelievable. McAfee Knob, which is like the most iconic photo that you can get on the Appalachian Trail, is in Virginia. And it's easy to plan because there used to be an app called Gut Hook, and it's now called Far Out. And it's so easy. It tells you, like, people are like, oh, there's water and you can camp here. And you figure out your mileage, find a trailhead, park, and then hire a shuttle to take you to the beginning. And then you just hike back to your car. It's some of the easiest planning you can do.
What do people need to know about permits or reservations, especially in Virginia? I know different national parks, pretty much anywhere you go has some sort of different policies, but what's typical or standard in Virginia?
Yeah, and it's a good question. So most wilderness areas don't require permits. So if you're in a wilderness area, you generally don't need a permit. That might, again, it does change. You can go to the National Park Service and like just type in where you're going and see if, you know, what they require, if there's a permit or not. You can also call the ranger office and ask, you know, tell them I'm going here, is a permit required? Now, state parks with primitive sites, and there are a few Virginia state parks that do have primitive sites. You do have to reserve the site ahead of time and you'll have to pay for it. But to be honest, while permits are required, and I always get a permit, you'll find a lot of people don't get them. But I think it's always best to be safe than sorry. If you have a permit, A, they know the rangers know you're out there, or that you're likely out there. And you know, it's the right thing to do, because it's there to make sure that the areas don't get overcrowded or overused. But I would say, you know, for the most part, like if you're in the Mount Rogers recreation area, you don't need a permit. Same for Jefferson National Forest. But when in doubt, just check the National Park Service site page for that area and see what they say.
Yeah, I think it's especially important that they know that you're out there, not just for your own safety, but if you leave your car somewhere and know, you know, the rangers or even the police or whoever is patrolling comes across your car and it's the middle of the night and nobody knows why it's there, that's not good. So definitely make sure you have a permit so that people know where you're going to be and when you're going to be back.
Yeah, I mean, it really is the right thing to do. So, yeah, I think there's just a lot of people that just go online, look, and they go, and they don't even think, like a permit might even be required. But actually, I think it's a $150 fine if you don't have a permit.
Oh, is it? I don't know what the fine is, but that's because I don't mess around. Follow the rules. I just do what you're supposed to do.
Yeah. And I also should mention a permit is usually for a group. It generally covers up to 8 people. So that's also something. So if you're taking a group out, or if, you know, there's 4 of you heading out, you should only need one permit.
Let's talk about safety a little bit more. You talked about having a GPS device and not skimping on safety items when you're purchasing your gear. But I'm just curious, how do you respond when someone tells you that solo backpacking is dangerous?
I laugh because I love this question. I get it all the time. I went through this with my mom when I first started doing this. You know, while there can be safety in numbers, like for example, you know, a bear comes through camp at night and you have 40 people scaring off the bear, there can also be danger in numbers. You know, I was recently, well, I guess last year I was at Campbell Shelter, which is right past McAfee Knob. And it was the through hiker bubble was coming through. So, you know, there were four of us and maybe like, you know, 30 some plus through hikers there. And a bear had been spotted a half a mile from the area. And just, you know, looking at the apps, we all knew that, you know, bears had been seen in this area. And, you know, they had food in their tents. People had food like hanging next to their tent, over their tent. I mean, there was food everywhere. There was food on the picnic table. That wasn't a good situation. I mean, granted, there were so many people there that, you know, if a bear did want to come through, you know, 40 people yelling at it might deter it. But it was still not a great situation that many people were being lazy with their food. And you'll see that. I mean, that's an extreme case, but I've been to other places where, you know, you get to a campsite, you know, you're there and there might be a couple of other campers there. You're kind of beholden to how safe they're being with their food. And you have to think about that, you know. And the other thing is, I also find it funny that people think just because you're not going out with somebody, like you don't, somebody's not in the car with you on the same planned trip, that means you're going to be alone. There are very, like, you got to work at being alone out in the woods. You have to find some very special place to go to. Generally speaking, you're going to run into other people, especially at camp. So you're almost never going to be alone. I mean, I would say, you know, I haven't really run into anybody that made me feel uncomfortable. If I did, I would pick up and move on somewhere else. I also do try to look for places where there are more than one person camping that night. You know, therefore, if somebody might be a little bit creepy, there's still other people around. But for the most part, you know, I don't think that you're any more or less safe. As long as somebody knows where you are, you know, somebody's got your plan, your route, when to expect you back, and you have a means of communication or an SOS type device, you know, I really feel like you're not any less safe per se than you would be in a group.
What tools do you use for navigation?
I like to use a mix of map and GPS on the phone. You know, I know a lot of people like really like, you know, you should use the maps. Maps are where it's at. But we have this technology on our phones, so it doesn't hurt. I like Gaia. I have Gaia Pro. I also use the Hiking Project and the Far Out app. Far Out is like the best for the Appalachian Trail. But I always do keep a paper map with me. Even if that's just something I copied off of like a web page or printed from a web page, you know, because things can go wrong with your phone. They can drop in water. They can fall out of your pocket and get crushed. And I've seen personally two phones at the bottom of privies. And, you know, if your phone falls in the privy, you're not going after it. Like, or if you do, you're not getting it back. That's just not going to happen. So it's really good to have a paper map with you. They're not necessarily as detailed as the GPS tracking you. But you know, if you know how to use a map and you have one on you, you can still navigate back to your car.
All of those apps that you just mentioned are apps that I absolutely love and I use frequently. One that I don't particularly like that I think a lot of people rely on a little too heavily is AllTrails. It just is not as accurate as people think it is, where something like Gaia GPS, it's pretty darn accurate. And you can get different types of maps and you can download it ahead of time so that if you don't have signal, it's still available on your phone. There's just so many different things you can do with it. It's not that expensive for an annual subscription. So it's worth every penny, I think.
Yeah. And actually Gaia now is part of the Outside company. And so you get, I believe, a free subscription to Outside with your Gaia Pro subscription. So it's a pretty decent deal. I have to agree with you with AllTrails. I know a lot of people love AllTrails. It's failed on me more than once, and it's crashed on me more than once at a very inopportune moments. I've just found Gaia more stable. To your point, though, I know a lot of people love all trails.
Yeah, they really do. And I think they use all trails to find hikes that they're going to do. So that's fine. But I've been on hikes with people where all trails says this is, 4 miles round trip and it takes, a certain number of hours. And we're out there twice as long, or we lose the trail because it's not where it says it's going to be. And then we're lost. And these things happen more frequently than makes it worth it. To me, it's not reliable if it keeps happening over and over again. And I know it's not just me. I talked to many people who are like, oh yeah, all trails kind of led us down the wrong way, or it told us to go somewhere and it wasn't really a trail, and then we were lost. And the last thing you want is to be lost. I can't think of anything scarier, to be completely honest, than being lost in the wilderness. So, have backup and don't rely on something that relies on user input to be accurate.
Well, I think that's the biggest thing. All trails and Gaia are both crowdsourced information. And I think with so many people using all trails, you get folks who are like, oh, this is the route. And I'm like, no, I've seen this before where you see people are like, oh, this is this hike. And I'm like, that's not that hike. You turned in the wrong spot, but that's what they think it is. Gaia, yeah, even though it's crowdsourced, it does seem to be more accurate. Also, the hiking project is free. And that is like you submit the route, but they verify it.
That's why they're really great tools. Do you have any favorite locations in Virginia or specific recommendations for a beginner to backpack or camp?
Yeah, I mean, my favorite place, I know I've mentioned this before, but I love Grayson Highlands. It's one of my favorite places. Now, I'm going to caveat this with you can't pitch a tent in Grayson Highlands. So you can actually the only backcountry camping they allow is at the Wise shelter, and you have to stay in the shelter. You're not supposed to pitch a tent near the shelter. However, Grayson Highlands is a nice little circle that is surrounded by the Mount Rogers Recreation Area and Jefferson National Forest, and you can camp in those. So even though I say like Grayson Highlands, the caveat is you're in Grayson Highlands, but overnight you're going to camp in the Mount Rogers Recreation Area. But that's only 50, like you're going to weave in and out. If you've ever been to Grayson Highlands, you know you weave in and out of those fences on the trails, and that's taking you in and out of the park. 50 yards past Wise Shelter is the Mount Rogers Recreation Area, and they actually put a bear locker out there, and you're closer to the water, and there's these beautiful campsites. You can also camp at the Thomas Knobb Shelter, which is just outside the park. Tons of camping there. Again, good water. There's a bear locker there. So that's why I say Grayson Highlands, but with the caveat that you're kind of technically a Mount Rogers.
I love that surrounding area because most people go directly to Grayson Highlands State Park. That seems to be the main attraction. And just down the road, there are these wonderful areas to camp that are practically empty because people are all going to Grayson Highlands.
Yeah, it's really funny. I mean, I actually just did a 40 miler on the Appalachian Trail, and we started on the far side of Grayson Highlands. So we hiked through Grayson Highlands, and then worked our way down to Damascus. And that was just, it was gorgeous. We paralleled the Virginia Creeper Trail at times, and at other times we were on the Virginia Creeper Trail, and there were people biking on it, and the river was right there, and we were walking along it. And I mean, beautiful, beautiful campsites all up and down the trail there. I mean, it was just really, really nice.
Were there other sites that you recommend?
Oh yeah, I definitely like that one. I think if you're getting started, I think that's a good one to start with. I also like Rock Castle Gorge. It's technically not backpacking. You're really, but it's great for your very first time, especially if you didn't take a course and you're starting out on your own. The campsite, and you do need a permit for the campsite. The campsite is maybe a quarter of a mile from where you've parked your car. So you get the feeling like you put your pack on and you get the feeling that you're backpacking. They do have a porta john there, and they do have bear lockers. But you get the sense of that you're not like you don't see your car. So you can camp, you can get everything set up, you're in a nice safe area. If something goes wrong, your car's a quarter of a mile away, and you can just give it a shot for the evening and see how it goes. And then there's some great places to day hike back and forth from there. But I think that's a good option if you're on your own teaching yourself how to backpack.
For the longest time, I didn't realize, well, I guess I should say, I didn't think about doing that, like, backpacking into a specific place, making camp, and then just day hiking from there. So you're not packing up your whole camp and carrying it on your back for, let's say you're doing a long weekend, the entire time and moving locations every night. You could just, set up camp and then day hike around the area and come back to camp at night. I think a lot of people don't think about that, but it's such a great way to ease into it.
Yeah, and it's known as base camping. Where you set up a base camp and then you go hiking back and forth. And the advantage to this is you can, depending on how far you're hiking everything in, you can carry a few extras and make yourself a nice little home away from home there. It's somewhere between backpacking and car camping. Again, depending on how far in it is, but it's nice to just set up shop and then you're not as tired because you were day packing with a day pack and you can go farther and see more things.
Can you explain to people where Rock Castle Gorge is in case they're not familiar with it?
Oh, that's a good one. So I know how I get to it. Rock Castle Gorge is right near Fairystone State Park.
So Fairystone State Park is not too far from Floyd, Virginia, and it's
Yes.
down in Southwest. Anybody can find a state park, so as long as you have a general idea of where that is, I think that's really helpful.
Yeah, it's literally a 5-minute drive from Fairystone State Park.
Excellent. Okay. So, Allison, I think we're getting close to the end of our time here. This has been so incredibly useful and helpful, I think, to talk about backpacking from a beginner's perspective and to overcome a lot of the hurdles. I'm sure people are going to have a lot of questions after listening to this that maybe you didn't answer in this conversation. So, how can folks connect with you if they want to ask more questions?
Absolutely. And I am here to answer questions. So you can follow me both and or direct message me on Instagram and Facebook at Exploration Solo. And my email is just my first name, Allison at explorationsolo.com. And then I try and make this easy. So the website is explorationsolo.com. Also for the gear, and I give my email subscribers a lot of like options and freebies and things that I hope are helpful. And one of them is my backpacking list for warm weather. So I can get you the link to that if anybody wants to kind of get an idea of like what would you pack.
That's
Like
so
this thing's
great.
detailed. It's all the way down to like hair tie and bandana.
That is so excellent because I feel like there's a lot of sources of bad information out there. We live in a world where there are social media influencers who put up really pretty pictures of their hiking and camping experiences, and people sometimes assume that those folks know what they're doing and take advice from them. And I would caution people where they're getting their advice from. Make sure it's somebody who actually is experienced in hiking and backpacking, and has an idea of what they're talking about, or you might get some information that could be really quite dangerous.
I've seen, I'm with you. I've seen a lot of information out there where I'm like, somebody's going to get hurt following that. Again, people have ideas, but one of the things is I teach beginners. And so, I try and give people like the pros and the cons because I've seen some people make choice A and some people make choice B, and both of them are happy with their choices. So I just try and give you the good and the bad so that you can be like, I can live with this, I can't live with that. And I think that's really how things should happen. I've also seen like 100 people make the same mistakes. So I hopefully try and get in front of that before it happens.
Okay, so I have two closing questions that I ask all my listeners. And one of them, I'm really curious to see what you're going to say because we just had this long conversation about gear. So the question is, what is one piece of gear you can't live without?
You are going to think this is so dorky and stupid, but I cannot live without my collapsible long spoon. it's so long that like I can go all the way into a bag of food without getting my hand in, but it folds in half, so it's easy packing. I actually think MSR is discontinuing them, so like I found them online and bought like six of them, so I have extras.
Can you send me one? Because mine are all short. And I was like, why didn't I not buy the longer spoon? I just didn't think that far ahead.
Absolutely.
You are a lifesaver. I definitely want one of those. But you know, like those are the little pieces of advice that you don't think about until you either have done it yourself or you know somebody who happens to mention it to you. Like that's the value in talking to other backpackers and people who are experienced in this. Like if you're looking at all these spoons or sporks or whatever it is, you don't think to yourself, oh, I'm going to need the one with the extra long handle because I've got to get all the way down into the bottom of the bag for the food.
Yeah, until your hand goes all the way down in the food, it's not a problem.
Right. Or then, you know, your spork is lost in the bag and you pull it out and the whole thing's covered in food and your hand is
Yep.
covered in food. Yeah. Yep. Been there, done that. Okay. And then what is your next big Virginia outdoor adventure?
Oh, you know, it's a little embarrassing that I have not been here yet, but I really want to visit Shenandoah National Park. I want to take like a week and really kind of get in and dig in and explore it.
Oh, well, that is my favorite place on earth. So as soon as you decide you want to come, I will meet you there and show you around.
That is a deal.
We can go backpacking on the AT if you want, or we could pick some different trails too.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard so many wonderful things about Shenandoah. I really just can't wait to get in there and see it for myself.
Oh, yeah. Well, now you've got me excited. So let's pick a date sometime soon. We'll make that happen. Okay, Allison, thank you so much for all of this amazing info. I mean, honestly, like, I think we could do this again sometime and just maybe ask listeners to submit some questions and sort of dig more into the weeds on some of this. This is sort of higher level stuff. And I would really love to just get into like more detailed information, but this is an awesome start. So thank you so much for being a guest.
Oh, I'm so glad it was helpful, and I do hope it was helpful for everybody. And thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely, Allison. Adventure on. Links and resources from this episode are in the notes section of your listening app and on the website at virginiaoutdooradventures.com. If you enjoyed the show, please consider supporting me. The easiest and most impactful thing you can do is visit buymeacoffee.com/JessicaBowser, where you can buy me a virtual coffee or sign up for a membership. Members receive access to the full list of show notes, Virginia Outdoor Adventures vinyl stickers, and a shout out on the show. You can also support me by subscribing to the show on your listening app. Help spread the word by sharing the show or your favorite episode with friends or on social media. Last but not least, leave a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts. I love hearing from my listeners. You can find me on Instagram and Facebook at Virginia Outdoor Adventures or on the website virginiaoutdooradventures.com. Thanks for listening. Until next time, adventure on.